Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Jacob's Pillow is a world-renowned dance festival and venue in the Berkshires. It features some of today's most gifted, imaginative dancers and choreographers. But flash back to 1940, and you'll find an organization on the verge of financial collapse.
The tides turned in 1941 when a 31-year-old pioneer stepped on the scene with a vision to develop a nonprofit international dance festival and training ground at Jacob's Pillow. That individual wasn't a businessman or an industry contractor. It was the legendary British prima ballerina Alicia Markova.
Markova's legacy is the subject of a new book by Tina Sutton, a fashion and feature writer for the Boston Globe. The book is called The Making of Markova. And Tina joins us live in the studio to shed light on the dancers' contributions to Jacob's Pillow and on ballet as a whole, in fact. Tina Sutton, welcome to Radio Boston.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. You've spent a whole lot of time getting to know intensely this woman. What was that process like of sifting through the archives, and what was she like?
She was truly a remarkable person, and for people who really don't care about ballet, they would still find her a person that they would love to learn more about, because interestingly enough to me, the fact that she was the greatest classical ballet dancer of her generation is almost the least interesting part of her life. She was also the most adventurous and groundbreaking. I mean, her entire career was just one first after another.
Yeah, and she had it tough in the beginning, didn't she?
Very tough. She experienced bitter anti-Semitism. She was the first openly Jewish, and I say openly because Anna Pavlova before her was Jewish but had to hide that fact because only Russians were ballet dancers, and that was another first for Markova. She was British-born, Lillian Alicia Marx, but only Jews were forbidden to attend ballet school in Russia. So Anna Pavlova had just always covered up that she was Jewish and begged people, even when she was world famous, not to tell anyone. Markova was very proud of her religion, and it was a very big deal in England what she had to go through to become a famous ballerina.
And physically, she was born with flat feet, she had knocked knees, and she was incredibly shy.
She didn't speak a word until age 6. Her parents took her to a doctor because they thought something was terribly wrong, obviously. And the doctor said, you know, she's a very happy, pleasant child. When she's ready to talk or has something to say, she will speak. But she was also very sickly, and she was homeschooled until she was 6 years old. So what happened is her legs kept buckling under her, and her parents took her to a doctor, and they said, well, she should wear leg irons for the next 2 years. And her mother thought, oh, this poor child, she's already so shy, she will never leave the house again.
So how did she overcome that, and what did you find in the archives that led you through her life? Because eventually she became a powerhouse. I mean, the first freelance dancer who used her own money to travel the globe, dance for people who otherwise would not have access to ballet. I think she danced in Johannesburg. She danced before the Zulus and watched the Zulus dance before her. She was also a real populist when it came to spreading the word of dance. How did she change so radically?
Well, she went from this shy, timid girl. She was discovered by Diaghilev. She was the youngest ever dancer at the Ballet Russe at 14 years old. And there, Matisse was her art instructor, if you can believe it, and also designed her first costume. Stravinsky was her music teacher. Balanchine choreographed his first ballet for her.
She hung out with Picasso.
And she hung out with Picasso.
Can we be her, please?
Oh, I didn't get to the part where Coco Chanel taught her about fashion when she was there. I mean, she met the best of the best. On the other hand, she remained mute, timid, shy. And what happened is when she returned to England after Diaghilev died, unfortunately, and she had to start all over British, there was no British ballet. The powers that be, without going into gory detail, were anti-Semitic and tried to keep her from dancing. What she had to do to get back in front of the public and become a popular dancer, she was a person who willed herself to be open and a better speaker. And Diaghilev had taught her a lot. He taught her to go to museums to study paintings and sculpture, to learn movements, to study modern art, to look at the world around her, the way a leaf falls, you know, could, you know, help her be more beautiful on stage. So I think one thing she had that most dancers, especially successful dancers don't have, is she had empathy. And she always related directly to the public. And what I found in the archives were all these articles and interviews with her that nobody had ever talked about, where instead of talking about, oh, you should come see Swan Lake because Siegfried does this, this, and that, and, you know, and no one could care less, she would talk to working women during World War II in the United States. And she said, you know, you're working in factories, your husbands and boyfriends are fighting this war. You must feel bad about yourself. That's how I always felt, because she was felt like an ugly duckling when she was a child. She said, I have a great idea for you. First, when you get home at night, soak your feet in milk. That's what keeps my feet beautiful. And rub them on marbles, and then they won't feel so tired and cramped. So she's talking directly to women. You know, who would do this? You would, you know, be talking about your life, and I'm so great, and I just left Paris. And then she'd say, and you know what's wonderful about ballet? It's escapism, and it will get you to forget your cares and woes for 2 hours. And the women just adored her. They felt like, this is someone who could be a friend of mine. And women, no matter how much money they had, went to the ballet, and she made it incredibly popular.
We should say she debuted the role of the Sugar Plum Fairy, the very first Sugar Plum Fairy in the Nutcracker at the Boston Opera House. She came here in 1938. It wasn't too easy for her here, though.
Actually, when she first came to the United States, her biggest problem was the sabotage from the Russian dancers. She was the only British prima ballerina. They were very jealous. They were angry. Her life was threatened before she went on stage in her premiere at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York.
By whom?
Tamara Tumanova was a famous, very beautiful Russian dancer. Her father knocked Leonid Messine, who is the art director, out cold because he wouldn't put Tumanova in the lead of Giselle and had given it to Markova. And then a note was passed to Markova saying, you know, don't dance Giselle opening night or else, dot, dot, dot. And they put in the most ridiculous security measures, like a head of state was coming there. And something that was very funny is they, all the stagehands were told you have to lock everything down because they're afraid, you know, something would fly and hit Markova. So there were certain props she was supposed to pick up on the stage, lilies, and they actually stapled them to the stage. You know, picture this ethereal ballerina leaning down to, you know, pick up the, and they said she wrenched it, you know, as if, you know, she were, you know, digging a hole in the ground, which was very funny. But back at the Boston Opera House, Tumanova's mother actually slashed her costume to bits and, you know, hid it in the ladies' room. So Markova never traveled without a backup costume because of all the sabotage.
Very smart woman. I want to get briefly in the time we have left to Jacob's Pillow and tell us about her contribution there. We spoke, though, Tina, earlier today to Norton Owen, who was the director of preservation at Jacob's Pillow, and asked him how Markova's legacy is expressed there today. And here's what he said.
One of the cabins that our interns live in here is named for her. It has photographs on the wall of her. It has a pair of her toe shoes hanging on the wall. But as recently as 1997, Markova was an honorary co-chair for the 65th anniversary season. So her memory here has always been a cherished one.
In a nutshell, what did this star of the Nutcracker do to help save Jacob's Pillow?
Well, it was in total disrepair. Ted Shawn had owned the property for 11 years, but by 1941, he had to put it up for sale. And he listed it with real estate developers, so it could be Jacob's Pillow Condo Resort today. Markova and her partner Anton Dolan had the idea of having a summer ballet school there, performing, bringing the whole ballet theater company, which she had just joined. She got so much attention drawn because of her fame that it was a huge hit.
And the rest is on the web. And in your book, Tina Sutton, author of The Making of Markova, Tina's going to be at the Brookline Booksmith next Thursday, August 15th.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Radio Boston.